You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. There has been so much talk and I suppose even a lot of dialogue and feelings, emotional feelings as to what's going on between the countries of Ukraine and Russia at this point. Of course, everybody's a Monday morning quarterback. Everybody has their own opinions as to what's going on, what's happening. But why do we have these types of flare-ups? So specifically, this is at hand. This is happening right now. But one country invading another is nothing new. We know during World War II, the Germans had done that with a number of neighboring countries and many more beyond that. But I don't want to give a history lesson this evening. I just want to focus on the topic at hand, and that's why I've invited my guest this week, Brown University Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, Omar Batov. Omar's joining us this evening, and I asked him to join us because I wanted to get his insight as to what's going on, you know, the motivations, the real reasons. I mean, we can all speculate, we can all listen to news broadcasts at the end of the day, but I think Omar Batov brings a different perspective to what's happening here. Omar, nice to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know as well as anybody that throughout history, there have been numerous countries, as long as, you know, if you read history books, there have been invasions, there has been leaders of nations who want to take over either for more power, for status, just want to add to their vast empires. And this doesn't seem to be any different. The only question I have, though, is, why would a nation, why would Russia, the USSR, why would a country so vast already have, domination in their region of the world? Why want to pick on the little guy, in this case, Ukraine? Is there more to it than just taking over a nation and expanding territory?
Well, you know, on the one hand, of course, you're right. Big countries invading small countries is not big news. It's happened a lot in the past. This is a very special case, though, for a variety of reasons. The first is that this has not actually happened very often after 1945 in Europe. So the Russian invasion of Ukraine is actually threatening to disrupt or destroy the entire balance that was created between the great powers after the defeat of Nazi Germany and the creation of the post-World War II world, especially in Europe, of course. So in that sense, this is a major event, and its consequences will really have major repercussions for the world we live in. The second thing is that Russia and Ukraine, you said the big guy attacking the little guy. So in Russia, from at least the 19th century, Ukraine is referred to as Little Russia. And the relationship between Russia and Ukraine is a very complex one. As you said, we can't do a history lesson here, but I would say that at least for now, it appears that for President Vladimir Putin, Russia is not really what it used to be. It's not really the Russia that he wants without Ukraine, and in a sense also without Belarus. So the Russian notion of what Russia is as a nation, as a political entity, is an empire. And without Ukraine and Belarus, Russia is not what it should be. And this goes back not only to the Soviet Union, which of course controlled Ukraine. Ukraine was a Soviet republic, as was Belarus, but way back into Russian history, going back to the 17th century. So in that sense, for Russia, Ukraine has to be part of Russia for Russia to be what it ought to be. From the Ukrainian point of view, we can talk about it. This is a very different matter, because Ukraine has been struggling, as Ukrainians would tell you, also at least since the 17th century, to be an independent political entity.
Okay, that's something that I think a lot, I'm glad you clarified that, Omar, because I think a lot of people don't realize that they have strived for independence for centuries. So this isn't just something that's been on the radar screen, let's say, in the last few decades. And you can certainly understand how these people feel. They've been through so much and thought that maybe they finally saw light at the end of the tunnel. I also want to, go back to Sue, your background. I know you're teaching at Brown University, but especially with a special concentration in Holocaust and genocidal studies. Why do those two areas appeal to you so much?
Well, I've been, I started really my career as a German historian, and I wrote about the German army, the Wehrmacht, and especially about its war on the Eastern Front, the invasion of the Soviet Union, which was the deadliest and largest military confrontation in history. But after working on that for a couple of decades, I sort of moved over to a greater interest in Eastern Europe as such, East European history. And that led me, also because of my own background, I was raised in Israel, to focus more and more on the Holocaust, but on the Holocaust not only as the genocide of the Jews that it was, but also the larger context of genocide in the 20th century, and to thinking about how the Holocaust fits into the larger scheme of war and genocide in the modern era. And that's something that I've been engaged in for many years. My last major monograph on that, a history book, was called Anatomy of a Genocide, and that was a book that really dealt with trying to understand what genocide looks like on the ground in one town. What happened in a town that is now in West Ukraine, in which Ukrainians, Poles, and Jews had lived side by side for 400 years, why at some point these groups turned upon each other, and quite apart from the larger genocidal context of German genocide against the Jews, destroyed that multi-ethnic town, which after World War II has remained as a purely Ukrainian town.
It's people don't realize. I mean, we know the bigger picture, as I mentioned at the outset, World War II and the Nazi invasion of countries, and certainly what took place and what happened during the Holocaust with Jews and the German army and the atrocities that were committed. I want to talk a little further about that, but I just want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest this week is Brown University Professor Omer Bartov, and Omer's specialization is on Holocaust and genocidal studies, but I've asked Omer to join us because of his insightfulness and his ability to see probably a little more clearer than most people this relationship, this need for one country trying to dominate another. In this case, we're talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what's been going over there. Omer, you would think, and this is this has always been something that I've dealt with, but don't have a clear sense of what's going on. I'm thinking, okay, here we are in the year 2023. This planet is vast. I don't know of any Russian people saying, well, we don't have enough room. We've got to take over. We need more land. We need more of this, or any nation for that matter. What I'm getting at, doesn't it really come down to egos, personalities, a particular leader needing power, something that they may even be lacking in their own personality? I mean, I'm trying to focus on, it starts with the leadership, but in most cases, and certainly Adolf Hitler was a perfect example. Do these people have to be megalomaniacs? I mean, do they have to be egotistical, nutcakes, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, fruitcakes. I would say, yes. I mean, I would say on one level, yes. And you've mentioned a few. You can talk about Hitler. You can talk about Mussolini. You can talk about Stalin. There are sort of example, certainly in the 20th century, and Putin in some ways fits into this pantheon, if you like, of leaders who want power. And power is accomplished through territory, through domestic control, and then external expansion. I think that's true, but I think it's insufficient in all these cases to explain it, because modern states in the 20th and 20th and 21st century need more than a power-grabbing leader in order to succeed in these kind of, or at least temporarily succeed in these kind of vast land grabs. They need popular support. They need to persuade the public that this is in the national interest, the national pride, national security, and so forth. And they do that often because there is already some kind of public sentiment about these matters. And that's what's important. You know, there was a big debate about whether Hitler was all about just power, a tyrannical will to power, or was the German people engaged in Nazism? Did the German people, large parts of it, become Nazified? This is something that I was writing about when I wrote about the Wehrmacht. Mm. To what extent was the Wehrmacht motivated not only by loyalty to each other or by a sense of security, but also by national socialist sentiments? And I concluded that it was, that many of these young men were actually ideologically motivated. And I think when we talk about Russia today, it's a bit hard, of course, to know, because there's no democracy in Russia. We can't really gauge public sentiment very accurately. But there is, it appears, a sentiment in Russia right now, even after this gruesome war that is going on with tens of thousands. No one knows precisely how many people have died on both sides, but large numbers. There is a sentiment in Russia today that is very patriotic. Putin, of course, has used the Russian memory of World War II, which is known in Russia and formerly in the Soviet Union as the Great Patriotic War, as a kind of reminder of what Russia can and should be and what it lost because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which he perceives as the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And there is a sentiment in Russia also about Ukraine, that Ukraine is this country, little Russia. Ukraine is the really Russians, only they're slightly less sophisticated than us, but they should be under us. They belong to us. They may not know it, but they are really part of the Russian nation. And there are large numbers of Ukrainians or people with Ukrainian names or people who have Ukrainian ethnicity who are Russian. And there are not a few Russians who live in Ukraine, ethnic Russians. Yeah. And so in that sense, you can succeed at least temporarily as a leader who wants to have power and wants to show that he has power by grabbing more territory. And as you say, Russia does not lack territory, by tapping into this kind of prior sentiment. The other thing that I would say is that although Russia is a vast country, Ukraine is a very important element there. It doesn't look that big when you compare it to Russia,
right,
but it is the largest country in Europe outside of Russia, and it's a land that's very rich, both in terms of its soil and in terms of its minerals. So in that sense, it's not simply any territory, but both historically and economically, very valuable. It was fought over also in World War II and in World War I for its vast resources.
So it's more than if I'm hearing you right, Omar, it's more than a power grab. There's really intrinsic value, to in the minds of the Russian government. But it's something else that I'm not going to say that I'm not aware of it, but you clarified it better than I think most people have, and that's the fact that, hey, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, the Russians don't want this. They're standing by this, you know, most of them are standing on the sidelines, silent. But what you did, and I think it's very true with Nazi Germany, there was almost a brainwashing, if you will, for lack of a better term, to convince, first of all, because you want your people behind you when you do something like this. When you invade another country, you don't want the vast majority of your populace to be opposed to this. So if I'm hearing you correctly, most of these people, these men, these people who invade other countries, already know that they've got the pulse of the nation, and that maybe not everyone agrees with what's happening, but you know, they use certain techniques. In this case, well, you know, this this country belongs to the motherland. We've got to bring it back, into the furrow here. So it sounds like before an invasion even begins, many of these leaders over time have had to really test the mindset and the opinions of the vast majority of their citizens. In hoping that they have them behind them. Does that sound accurate?
Yes, I would say so. And if they don't, and that has also happened, then they may lose. And so if you take, say, the case of the Soviet Union invading Afghanistan, it was very hard to persuade Russia and said Afghanistan is any part of old Russian history. If you think about the United States in Vietnam, as long as the United States was fighting with generally with professional troops, with a small military component, well, people said it's part of America's wars. When America decided that it had to have general conscription, then people said, why should we go and fight in a country way far from America? People were not persuaded, as they were not, say, in the case of France, fighting in Nigeria. Once you are saying to people, I'm going to conscript all of you now for a great national undertaking, then you have to persuade people that it's worth dying for. This is, by the way, the challenge that Putin had, because when he declared that he's going to conscript another 300,000 men, it didn't really work so well, which is why he turned to Prigozhin, to someone who had really mercenaries. And while he's still not sufficiently tapping into the vast manpower reserves of Russia, because he's afraid that once you do that, people are beginning to pay a personal price across Russia, including the Russian middle class in St. Petersburg, in Moscow. People, by and large, been able to stand on the sidelines, and who previous to the war had profited from Putin's economy, then public sentiment can change. And so it's not that it's a given. You have to make sure that the war you fight, especially not a war of defense, but a war of aggression, which by definition is also an illegal war, that war is seen by your public either as not too costly to them, or as part of a real national crusade or national defense.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I know that you focus, and we're focusing here on with this current situation on Eastern Europe. But as you've brought up in many of your books, and I'm sure in much of your studies, in your work at Brown University, the fact of the matter is, and we talked about Nazi Germany, a perfect example there, how many people, how many of Germans, I should say, really believe that the Führer was doing the right thing. And then Hirohito, right? Japan, the Japanese dynasty. I mean, I certainly wasn't around then, but what I've read is that the Japanese people believed, at least at the outset, that this was all well intended. So these leaders really play mind games. But as you said, it's a necessary evil, Omar, because they need to have the people on their side. But as now this has been ongoing now, and I'm starting to see, and I'm, you know, I just want to get your sense as to how accurate, we're understanding all of this. We're starting to see cracks in the wall, if you will. Groups now organizing, trying to oppose what Putin is doing. You're hearing more and more news broadcasts saying that, he hasn't got long. He'll be taken out by some of these mercenaries. Do you see this thing crumbling? In other words, not falling in his, not playing out the way he intended?
You know, I think it's really hard to tell. I would not pretend to be able to say how this will work out. It's really, really hard to say. Putin is in a somewhat vulnerable position, I would say, because unlike, say, Soviet leaders accumulated a lot of power, but there was a party behind them. There was a whole apparatus behind them. So even when Stalin died, yes, people were sort of shocked, what do we do next? But immediately this position was filled by other people from the party. Putin doesn't have that. Putin has accumulated so much power and has gotten rid of so much of the competition that if he goes, nobody knows what Russia is going to look like, and many Russians are afraid that they'll go back to the old Yeltsin days, to the kind of chaos that existed in Russia with the fall of the Soviet Union. So part of what is keeping him in power, and you could say that about a number of tyrants, dictators, chief party chiefs such as Xi Jinping and so forth, part of what is keeping them in power is the fear that if they go, there will be chaos and a memory, a national memory of what chaos looks like.
Yeah.
So I think we don't know. Someone said that when you go to a Russian leader to talk with them about their policy, you come with a gun. You don't just come to tell them you're wrong. You come and say, you know, I'm going to now lead you either to the cemetery or to retirement. If you don't do that, then you better not try.
Yeah, that's a, I mean, I'm laughing, but you know what? If you're in that position, you almost want to go in with that attitude that, look, it's either it's our way or the highway. It's not going to,
exactly.
There's no other way. It's so interesting, Omar, that, you know, people always say, I hear, and just talking with neighbors or just people in general locally, I'm talking about how can this one guy be such a bully? Why don't they just take him out? But like you said, you got to tap into the emotional situation and the atmosphere that's going on with the Russian people. They don't want to take one forward and two steps backward. They want to go forward, and maybe deep down in their hearts, they don't want this either. But as you said, they don't want the chaos. And I think that's always been the case whenever you get these leaders who believe in domination of other nations or other people, that they've got the pulse of the, as I said earlier, of the population at large. We've only got a few moments, but I got to ask you now, when you present issues like this, or when you, and I'm talking about in the classroom with, you know, the students at Brown University, especially because you deal with a topic that, you know, can excite people in one respect, it can bring anger to others. So when you're presenting issues like this, especially, as I said, Holocaust and genocidal studies within the classroom, are you getting are young people vastly interested in this stuff?
Well, you know, I mean, Brown University has the great advantage of having an open curriculum, which means that people who take your class want to take your class. They don't have to. They can choose other classes.
Mm-hmm.
I teach a class and have taught it now for a long time on modern genocide and other crimes against humanity. That's how it's called. And I often, when I begin the class, I say, you know, in this class, you're going to be exposed to a lot of gruesome stuff, you know, very difficult documents, very difficult readings, images. So this is a warning. If you think you can't take it, don't take the class. The people who stay, and there are a lot of people who stay, my experience has been, and I've heard over the years from students, very important to them, because they learn about the sort of underbelly of the modern period. And we have a tendency, certainly in the West, to think of our lives as part of a general process of progress. We are always becoming better. We are always improving as societies, as in politics, in our personal lives. And when you see how easy it is to turn things around and to take peaceful societies and turn them into slaughterhouses, and you try to understand how does that happen, then you get another, I would say, another dimension of the modern era. And many of my students, as are many Americans in general, trace themselves to very different backgrounds, and they find those backgrounds in the class that I teach, because we talk about violence in the 20th and 20th and 21st century across the world. And in many cases, this is the world that they came from, and they discover aspects of it that they never knew. So I think it's very important. I started teaching this class in the early 2000s at Brown on the assumption that young Americans should know about this part of the world. And I still believe that it's important to study that.
And I couldn't agree with you more, Omer, and I'm so glad that young people do tune into this, whether it's for personal reasons or just to get a better understanding as to, you know, how the evolution of the world, and it is the world, because maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's not here in the United States today, but we've had these issues. Europe is certainly going through it, various parts of Europe, I should say, vast regions of the world. I mean, I don't think there's any part of the world or any country that hasn't at one time or another throughout history not seen something, maybe not to the same level as perhaps, you know, World War II, World War I, but everybody's had, you know, had experienced somebody either wanting to take over their country or their country invading another country. So I think it is, and I'm glad to hear that young people do still have an interest in how this all evolves. And hopefully the next leader of this country may be one of those people sitting right in one of your classrooms. With the few moments we have left, I have to ask, I know there's numerous books out there. The newest book right now, though, is widely available, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's the book is called The Butterfly and the Axe, mm-hmm. and it's an attempt by me to fill in the gaps in the historical record of what happened in Ukraine in World War II, and in that very personal aspect of it, where parts of my own family were murdered in West Ukraine with very few traces left of what actually occurred there. So yeah. What I tried to do was to write a novel based on historical materials that tries to reconstruct a story that I cannot construct from actual historical documentation, but had to imagine on the basis of what I know.
Yeah, I mean, and so really personal insight. Quickly, though, if people want to pose questions, get more information about you, your background, how might they reach out to you, Omer?
So they can email me at omer_bartov@brown.edu. They can also look up my Twitter feed. It's @bartov_omer. And if they want to find a book, then they can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Yep. And the spelling of Omer's last name is Bartov. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, Brown University Professor Omer Bartov, for joining us in a lively discussion on the current situation between Ukraine and Russia, but also on a more on a wider and more expansive global picture, what happens throughout history. We've seen this time and time again, the motivations, the reasons. So I really hats off to Omer for joining us this evening. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.